Ooh. The battery is very low. I hope, well, we'll find out. Good morning. This is the 17th of March, is it?
Okay. Yep. St. Patrick's Day. Tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day?
17th of
it. Okay. 17th, I think it is. Anyway, it is the 17th of March. This is Shabbat morning at Narkees. My name is Randall Booth, and we're going to be looking at a topic today. We'll briefly look at the book of Acts and review something that I think we've shared about before at this Bible study. And then we're going to look at a phenomenon in the book of John who is maybe unique in the world of scholarship on the New Testament, because John uses the word Hebrew, and New Testament scholarship is convinced that, at least if anybody uses it this way, John uses the word Hebrew to mean Aramaic. So we're going to look at that, look at his examples. And I've actually learned something in the last month as I've been looking and trying to figure out where his examples are coming from. I've been quite surprised. So I'll share some of those surprises with you during the next 40 minutes or so. First, if you will either turn or remember the book of Acts, chapter 21 and 22, there is a story that we don't need to read because this is review and fast. You all remember that Luke is writing. He records that Paul comes to Jerusalem and he goes to meet with the church leaders. Paul talks with them, and James tells him, Paul, we've heard bad things about you that we know are not true. We've heard things that you teach Jews to forsake the law. And yet you see how many tens of thousands of us here are all zealous for the law. And I'll underline the word all. This wasn't something optional. The whole Jerusalem church were keeping the law. They were still visiting the temple, worshiping in the temple. They were still performing sacrifices. We're talking three decades after the crucifixion and resurrection. And this, of course, is something that is quite mind-boggling, especially to post-Reformation Christians, Protestant Christians that love the book of Hebrews and Galatians, where there's this very stark dichotomy between works of the law and grace, and the law is this old thing that's fading away, disappearing. And if the thing is fading away and disappearing, then what is it doing in chapter 21 of Acts? Well, we've discussed that before. But we're going to pick up from there and jump into the riot that follows, because they say to Paul, show us in your actions that the rumors aren't true. Here's what you do. Go up to the temple and offer the sacrifices for these men under a vow. Paul says, I can't do that. It's a matter of principle. And you know how where I stand on principle. You know, I'll go all the way on principle. And he will. And so he said, good, because by principle I believe that that's right. So he goes up to the temple to offer sacrifices. While he's there, some people recognize him and the people with him. And he says, oh, they're polluting the temple. He's bringing Gentiles in here. He didn't, but they're assuming, since he's from the diaspora, that he was doing things that weren't permitted. There, you know, there was a sign around a certain area in the temple that said no foreigner is allowed to go beyond this barrier. So a riot starts. And they're Well, you know what riots are like. Imagine a mob surrounding Paul, and they're screaming at him. And I expect that at some point during the riot, Paul gave them some kind of answer, but when people are angry, they often don't hear what the other person is saying. So there's a riot, and it gets out of hand so that the Roman guard from the Antonio Fortress come down into the temple area, and they question the people. What is this? What's going on? Why are you beating up on this guy? What did you do? So they inquire, and it doesn't tell us what they said or it just says that they were making inquiries. Now, what language do you suppose they were using? These are Roman soldiers. They weren't using Latin. They were in the Eastern Mediterranean. The Roman government basically used Greek in the Eastern Mediterranean. However, the soldiers tended to be recruits from the Eastern Mediterranean, so the soldiers would probably know some Greek, because I imagine there would be Greek commands given to the soldiers. They could assume a Greek shared language. The soldiers learned, while they're in the army, they certainly would have learned Roman commands, attention in Latin. I'm sure they learned that. Lances forward, etc. And many of these soldiers, because Greek was the high language in the Middle East, it had spread all over the Middle East under Alexander the Great, but it was the high language. And before Greek was the high language, there was another high language used all over the Middle East, and that was Aramaic. So many of these soldiers would have known Aramaic. We know that from Josephus. There's a siege of Gamla where people are... some Roman soldiers actually sneak into the city and they listen to a family having dinner. Well, not family, these were some of the rebels from the Roman perspective having dinner, discussing their plans of how they were going to defeat the Romans. And so the people listened to all that. They then killed the family and snuck out of the city. And Josephus says that they were able to understand them because they were Syrians. Now that means that these Roman soldiers, does he say Syrian or not? I don't remember. But anyway, he says they were locals and were able to understand the thing. I've got that written in here someplace and I just forget his description. In any case, these are Roman soldiers who know Aramaic. And this is not to be thought of as uncommon. Aramaic is a language that was native to what is Syria, what is today northern Iraq, Syria, eastern Turkey. That's the area where Aramaic was native. So soldiers coming out of that area are all going to know it, as well as in many other places around the Middle East. So what language did they use? Well, if we just had Acts 21 up through the riot, we wouldn't know. They might have used Greek. They might have used Aramaic. But verse 37 is a big clue. In verse 37, the soldiers are leading Paul away for protective custody because he was going to be ripped to shreds. So in verse 37, Paul turns to the leader and says, by the way, would it be okay... Maybe that's 36. I'm doing this by memory. Okay. By the way, would it be okay if I gave a speech to this crowd?
That says something to you.
I'm sorry?
Say something to you.
Oh, may I say something to you? Okay, the speech comes later. He asks permission to speak later, but he says, may I say something to you? Can I have a word with you, Tribune, sir? And the man turns in surprise and says, what? You know Greek. Now, what does that tell us about the inquiries and investigation that had just been going on?
Something different. In Greek.
Something different.
Not Greek before.
Not Greek before. It's at this point that the Tribune learns that Paul speaks Greek. He assumed the guy didn't speak Greek. That tells us that that riot was probably taking place in Aramaic, which would be a very commonsensical language to use in Jerusalem. It is part of the Middle East. Aramaic was it's the official language from the Persian era, and it was a very common business language still in the first century. So if you had diaspora Jews visiting in the temple, Aramaic was a great language to use. You could assume that people would know it, or Greek. So Paul says, "Can I speak to the crowd?" And then the Tribune says, "Well, go right ahead here, you know." And he keeps the crowd away from Paul. And then Paul turns to the people, and you all know what's coming. Luke records that he changed languages again. And this time, Luke names the language. He says, and he spoke to them Evraisti in Hebrew, and the people got quiet. Now, why did the people all of a sudden get quiet? Why did Luke mention the language? And the answer, the common sense answer, is that this was the third language in this riot scene. The riot took place in Aramaic. The discussion with the Tribune was in Greek. And now Paul turns to these people who think that the law is being broken, and he addresses them in Hebrew. The people understand the Hebrew. Paul speaks in Hebrew. Luke names it as Hebrew. And that word Hebrew, in the first century in Greek, meant... Now you can't look it up in the dictionaries, because the dictionaries, if you look it up, will say meant Aramaic. But in fact, we can't find anywhere in the Septuagint, in the Pseudepigrapha, in Josephus, in Philo, in Papyri. We cannot find anywhere where Evraisti means Aramaic. The Greek word for Aramaic was Syriake, Syristi.
Where does it say that it says that it means Aramaic?
In the basic New Testament Greek dictionaries, it will say Evraisti. This means Jewish Aramaic.
Like, this is English Standard Version. It translates in the Hebrew language and has a footnote, and it says, or the Hebrew dialect that is Aramaic.
I have the
Aramaic is not a dialect of Hebrew.
No, of course not. But that's
But they just assume that Hebrew wasn't spoken. Therefore, if Paul says it was in Hebrew, it must be Aramaic.
Here, listen to this translation.
Well, it's a big assumption.
They were all silent, and he said to them in Aramaic, and the footnote said, or possibly Hebrew, or possibly
Hebrew.
Okay, now, here's the thing that's funny.
Yeah, most translations are like that.
Here's the thing that's funny. They say it's Aramaic, and then this person says, or possibly Hebrew, but if you follow the logic of the context, it's only Aramaic. Only Hebrew. And only Hebrew fits this context. Hebrew would explain why the crowd got silent. As I just mentioned, if you're from the diaspora, if you're coming from some faraway land and you're a pilgrim, people are going to expect that you speak either Greek or Aramaic. Those are the two international languages in the Middle East. Sort of like French and English were for the last couple hundred years. Although now, sad to say that one of those two languages doesn't have the same international stature, but we won't go into that.
They still think they do.
That's it.
Ils pensent comme ça, mais ce n'était pas vrai.
Well, the other one's going to go out too.
It will go the way of all languages eventually,
right.
Yes. Anyway, back to this scene. So this is the background to Acts 21 and 22. Here is this man associated with the diaspora. and he opens his mouth, and out comes something that silences them, and they stop to listen. He was speaking in fluent Hebrew. They're going, whoa, where'd this guy come from? And he gives his sermon. The end of the sermon, well, he's not at the end of the sermon, but at some point he mentions about traveling to the Gentile areas, and all of a sudden the silence is broken, uproar, and the tribune is confused, and the tribune says, huh, what in the world caused that uproar?
Because they're lost when he starts speaking in Hebrew.
They're lost when he starts speaking Hebrew, so he doesn't know what's going on, and so he does need to find out.
And they wouldn't necessarily have a translator on hand that could that would be able to
say
speak in their ear, right?
They wouldn't necessarily have a Josephus on board the way they did when they were sieging Jerusalem 30 years later.
But possibly they would have an Aramaic translator, but...
Oh, they wouldn't even need it. Possibly half of the troops spoke Aramaic as their first language.
So Aramaic and Greek was for sure the Hebrew. Yeah. Don't you think that's why he asked them, can I talk to the crowd? Because
okay, that's a good
they're
point.
They're not going to be able to understand.
And
one of the points...
Yeah.
One of them is seditious.
One of the... Well, except they don't stop him when he switches language.
Right.
They may have been surprised. Now, all of that is true. That is, I think, what happened. They were surprised and they wanted to find it out. However, I will have to say this in favor of the Aramaic people. Even if he had been speaking in Aramaic, the tribune still wouldn't have understood. Because he says, and then when I traveled off to the Gentile, to the Gentile areas, and all of a sudden, come on! That's what we just did a week ago, when they read the book of Esther, and every time they read Haman, they make noise. So he mentions the Gentiles, and they're pretending like it's Haman when they're reading the scroll of Esther. And they just run berserk. Language, there is more to communication than just the language you choose. It's also the culture and the background. And even if Paul were speaking in Aramaic, even if he were speaking in Greek, the tribune would not have understood. Why did they blow up right here? Unless he understood the halakhic issues and the view of the law that was being supported by the riot, he would not have understood why at that point the people went crazy. Earlier in the speech, he'd already mentioned that he went into the temple. He went into the temple and, this and this and this, and no riot. But when he mentions Gentiles, riot. So the tribune, needed more than the language to understand the riot. But in this case, you're right, Danny, he wasn't understanding. He hears a riot. He says, this needs more investigation. Take this man out and have him flogged until we know the truth. This is
in good Roman fashion.
First century PC. First century political correctness. So anyway, this is the background to Evraisti. What does it mean? It means Hebrew. Luke is using the word exactly like all the other Greek authors use the term. Evraisti meant Hebrew. It did not mean Aramaic, and the context in Acts 21 and 22 makes it clear that only Hebrew fits Luke. And now we get to our topic today. What about John? Of all the writers in the ancient world, we have an author who writes, and now I'm writing on the board, those of you listening, in the internet land, I'm writing Vedzatha or Vedthesda. That's from John 5:2, and I'm going to write here Gabbatha. And that's from John 19.
Maybe also transliterate over there.
13. I'll do that in just a second. But you can hear it. Gabbatha, Bethzatha, Bethesda, Gabbatha, and there's one more word that is very famous, and that is
Rabuni.
Transliterated.
Okay, so they want it transliterated, and so over here we're going to write Rabuni, and we're going to write, I'm going to write a capital G because these are names, Gabbatha, and names, the fact that it's a name is important, and Bethesda and Bezatha. We can start, I don't know where to start from. I'm going to start with Rabuni because it's the easiest. Rabuni is a word that if you look in a commentary, it will often say this is an Aramaic colloquial word that means my teacher, my rabbi. And the reason they say that is because they know the word rabbi, rabbi, and so Rabuni is not Rabbi, so they assume this must be Aramaic. And what is interesting about it is, well, the whole shape of the word and the vowel A. In the old Targum, it's Riboni. In Aramaic Targums, it's Riboni. But something, we've made some discoveries in the 20th century. We found in some Targums,
which are from Aramaic translations.
Aramaic translations of the Hebrew Bible from manuscripts from the late first millennium BCE. First millennium CE, coming out of Cairo, we found the term Rabuni with the A, which is very important. Here is confirmation of the vowel that is showing up in our Greek texts. Remember, our old Semitic texts don't have vowels, so people didn't always get to know which way they were pronounced. And also, we have different dialects. Well, another thing was found in the 20th century. It turns out that in the Mishnah, which is a 200 AD Hebrew document, we also have the term Rabuni attested. But it's not in our printed Mishnah, just like Rabuni is not in our printed Targum. It's in Codex Kaufmann, which is the manuscript of the Mishnah. It is the one when people study Mishnaic Hebrew, you know, what does Kaufmann have? It is head and shoulders above all other manuscripts in terms of carrying weight with Mishnaic Hebrew scholars.
That's King James.
What?
It's like the King James.
It's like the King James of English. Or, in any way, it is the Mishnah. And Codex Kaufmann has the form Rabuni. And how do we explain what's going on with these forms? And about 50 years ago, a professor across the valley at Hebrew University by the name of Kucher pointed out that Rabuni is a Western pronunciation. It's a Western dialect of the word Rabuni. And of course our earliest attestation is now the Mishnah, because the Mishnah was recorded before the Targums were recorded. So our earliest attestation is Hebrew.
And John's even earlier.
John's even earlier. We'll get to that in just a second. The Targum also has Rabuni, and so Kucher explained it. He says Riboni has come from Eastern manuscripts, from manuscripts that were copied in a Babylonian tradition, whether Hebrew or Greek, meaning in Mishnaic manuscripts, influenced from the Babylonian dialect, it became Riboni. From Aramaic manuscripts, influenced by the Babylonian dialect, it became Riboni. But as we see in Codex Kaufmann, Rabboni, as we see in the Targum to the Targums found in the Cairo Geniza, Rabboni, and as we find in John, Rabboni. Now, which language is this? The only way we would know what language this is if somebody told us, or if we heard it in the middle of speech. If you heard it in the middle of Hebrew, it's Hebrew. If you heard it in the middle of Aramaic, it's Aramaic. So, we don't know what language it is unless somebody tells us. So, John, please tell us what language it is. And John says, it's Hebrew. So you go, okay, so it's Hebrew. So why do the New Testament commentaries...
Verse?
It is John chapter 20, verse 16.
But in my translation, she says in Aramaic.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I'm telling you is that...
And many translations do.
What I'm telling you is that John tells us it's Hebrew, but within New Testament scholarship, wherever John or people in the New Testament say Hebrew, they will typically interpret it as Aramaic. It's their worldview. And that's a long... how that happened is a long story.
Even this one says Aramaic. Wow. The other one said Hebrew and footnote Aramaic. This one says Aramaic in the main text.
It says Aramaic
and
in the main
footnote
text.
Or Hebrew.
Footnotes or Hebrew.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm surprised even but that they went so far as to say Hebrew there. So, what is it? Well, according to John, it's Hebrew. Maybe I'll try to do it in about 2 minutes, because we still need 5 minutes for each of these. To give you some prior examples, when I say that Evraisti means Hebrew and Surisi means Aramaic in Greek, how do we know this? Well, you all know the story of the Assyrian that comes up to the wall with Hezekiah and says to the people up on the wall, if you listen to Hezekiah, you're going to eat your bleep. Okay, you all know that story.
Yes.
And Hezekiah said, don't speak Hebrew, speak Aramaic. You know, we're all men of the world here.
Is that a reference on that? Where's that story at?
That is in Isaiah 36, verse 11 and 12.
Also 2 Kings.
2 Kings. Anyway, the same story is in Josephus, same differentiation. You can go to the, later in the Septuagint, you come to a late book like Ben Sira. Ben Sira, we found it in Hebrew, the original. And the Greek introduction says, now, words that are in Hebrew don't have the same meaning when you translate it into Greek. So I'm doing my best to translate my... Was it his father or grandfather? I forget.
Grandfather.
I'm translating my grandfather's book into Greek. So bear with me. He called it Hebrew, Evraisti. Did he know any better? Yes, he knew better, and he was referring to a Hebrew book, of course. This is Ben Sira, or otherwise called Ecclesiastic Puss. Excuse me, Danny.
Or you can also call it...
I did jump a little bit.
There's another name, too.
The
Wisdom of Sirach.
Now, Wisdom of Sirach. Okay, now, more background. In the Septuagint in the book of Job, at the end of Job, the translator says, and you need to know this, that Job's Hebrew is really strange. He uses words with meanings in, context and with meanings that no Hebrew writer anywhere else ever used with that meaning. The dialect is strange. Nobody knows where that dialect comes from. And it's problematic. So what does the translator for the Septuagint say at the end of the book? He says, I used the Syriac book for translating this text that you have. What?
Which is what everyone else...
Which is apparently what other people were doing, or at least wanting to do. The book of Job is a unique book in antiquity. Not only do we have that reference at the end of the Septuagint that refers to Aramaic, correctly in Greek by Syriake, we have two copies of an Aramaic Targum found at Qumran. We have two stories related to the Gamaliel family around the temple in Jerusalem where they bring him a scroll. We have the story itself. They bring him a scroll, a translation of Job. And he says, bury it with the mortar and bricks here. We don't know what that means either. That's ambiguous. Is that respect because he's treating it like scripture, or is it abuse because he thinks nothing of it? We don't know. But and then the second story is his grandson, where they say, now, you know, your grandfather, same thing happened with him. You better be careful using that Aramaic translation of Job. And the two copies at Qumran, one of them actually shows from its spelling that it was a document that came out of the East, which makes sense, since the East is where Aramaic was the native language. Okay, all of that is to show that Greek writers distinguished Hebrew and Aramaic, and later we have things like the Aristeus letter, where the servant is answering to the king. The king says, how's my library going? And the servant says, well, you know, there's some books we need to add. The Jews have something they call the law. This would be a worthy collection, but there's a problem. And the king says, well, what's the problem? He says, well, everybody thinks that these people speak Aramaic, Syriake, they have a good Greek word for this, but in fact they don't. They speak another language, and we need them to translate this book because it was the Hebrew Bible. Yes?
I looked up Isaiah 36, that's funny. It says, pray I speak thee in the Syriac language, for we understand it, and speak not to us in the Jews' language.
Okay.
That's King James.
Okay, that's King James, and
in the Jews' language.
Let me clarify that. The time, you've got to look at the time period. That is 8th century, 730. 734, I don't remember. 722, I've...
Yeah.
701, I'm getting confused. The point is that at that time, there was no northern kingdom. The northern kingdom had been... That's where my dates came from, excuse me. The northern kingdom had been taken away. You only had the Judean kingdom. And so he was referring to the language of Judea.
Which is the same Hebrew language, but...
It's the same Hebrew language, but different dialect.
Yeah, Yehudit would have been... Okay.
It was a different dialect. In any case... Now we...
You said all of this to say...
All of this to say that Greek writers distinguish Hebrew from Aramaic. They had words for it, and every place we look, including Josephus, they're always consistent. When they say Hebrew, they meant Hebrew, and there are good grounds for their saying Hebrew. When they said Aramaic, they meant Aramaic, and there are good grounds for seeing it as Aramaic. There is consistency. There is no example where Hebrew clearly means Aramaic, except for what we're about to look at now. All of these words, Bezatha, Bethesda, Gabatha, they all end in A. And Aramaic loves to put A at the end of nouns because that's their word for the.
And these words are all from John.
And these words are all from John. And so people say, well, even though it's not clear in any other author anywhere else in the world, at least with John, it's clear. And so I looked at some of these. Well, let's go back to Gabatha. The president of SIL about, not SBL, the president of SBL about, oh, it's been 40 years now, was giving a speech on languages of Palestine, and he said, you know, a lot of these we know very well, like Gabatha comes from Aramaic, and he pronounced it as Gabeta. He says this is clearly Aramaic, Gabeta, meaning a raised place, a high place. It sounds reasonable. If you think etymologically, you go, sure, why not? Problem is, what if you start trying to think in Aramaic? It's like, well, where do we ever use the word gabata? Where does gabata occur? And you get out your concordances and your dictionaries and you start looking through all the Aramaic dialects, through Syriac, which is an Aramaic dialect, the biggest one, main one that's attested for us today, and there is no gabata. So then he said clearly, and he fortunately footnoted it, to Dalman, words of Jesus, and so you get to look up in Dalman, words of Jesus, and in Dalman, words of Jesus, he says, oh, here are all of these foreign words, and I explain what they mean in my grammar, so you can go there, except for the word gabata, which I mis-explained in my grammar, and now I say that it comes from gabata, meaning baldness of the forehead. Well, gabahat is a word that's both Hebrew and Aramaic. Why the ah? Do I have time? I do have time. Ah is often the preferred form of choice. If Greek authors have a choice of two forms, they very often will choose ah forms when they're writing either a Hebrew or Aramaic word in Greek. And we see this time and time again, starting with the Septuagint. Pascha. Pascha has ah. The form actually comes from Aramaic, but the word Pesach, when they're transliterating Pascha in the Septuagint, they're talking about the Hebrew word Pesach. Why do they use Pascha? Because the Septuagint was done in Alexandria, where they had large communities with interface between Aramaic and Greek. So the Pascha form, and it's easier for them to say. So the preferred Greek form has the ah. Gabahat means baldness. Is that the name of the lithostrotos? I don't think so. The lithostrotos means paved in stone. It may have been some beautiful courtyard that had a mosaic.
Did you give the context of what you're talking about?
No.
The verse in John?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't. Thank you. Gabata comes in John 19:13, and it is where Jesus is on trial before Pilate, and he brings them out to the lithostrotos, which is a Greek word that means paved in stone. Why paved in stone? Well, some people said, well, this is a street, and all the other streets were mud, and here is a street that was paved in stone, so he called it paved in stone.
That's the only gospel that mentions it?
Yes. Yeah. Probably not. More likely, Pilate was up at the Herodian palace up on top, and he's taking them to a courtyard that in Greek was called lithostrotos.
I left off another word. I'm sorry. Very famous one.
You only have time for...
I know. Okay, well, let's get to these. Gogota, I skipped over. I saw four and thought I was complete because there's only four words in John, but...
And that was in John 19:17.
13. And Gogota is 19:17. Anyway, Gabata is this courtyard in the palace that's called Lithostrotos. Perhaps it had a beautiful mosaic, or perhaps there was another reason for that. Well, the Lithostrotos, paved in stone, is referring to something that's in the ground there in stone that's special. So perhaps there's some kind of mosaic that's in the ground that got its name. But in Hebrew, John says, they called it Gabata. Gabata. And... what could it mean? Well, Dalman now says it's forehead baldness. Do we have any? There, we have some gabahat over there.
Forehead baldness.
And yeah, that would qualify as gabahat. Danny, you're working on it. So, that's possible that for some reason we have no idea that it got the name forehead baldness. Great. There's something I think is more likely, and that somebody about 60 years ago wrote, and he said, you know, there is a word.
Delish.
No, it wasn't Delish. For not Gabata. His name was Charles Cutler Torrey, a very famous Aramaicist. He said, Gabata is Latin. It's a word in Latin. Gabata means a dish, a platter, a plate. So why would they name the courtyard the Gabbata, the plate? And the answer could be whatever was in the mosaic. You know, Greeks love to put mosaics in their dishes and plates. We won't go into that here either.
Or even the shape of the area.
Or even the shape of the area may have resembled a specific form of plate that was being sold or brought in by some of these Romans that they called a Gabbata.
So the question is, how did a Latin word become Hebrew?
Well, how did a Latin word become Hebrew? How does any word enter a language? If something comes in with a name, you borrow the name. And the common, everyone knows today that a radio all over the world is radio, radio, whatever, because the word travels with the item. So all over the world, everybody brings that word into their language.
Or like jeans.
Or
many languages there's call them jeans.
Many languages borrow words. It happens all the time. So what this man was saying was that Gabbata had been borrowed and used as a name for this courtyard. But it was borrowed in Hebrew, not in Greek. In Greek they called it Lithostrotos. But in Hebrew they didn't translate Lithostrotos. They called it Gabbata. And I think he's right. Gabbata fits, the Latin fits exactly. Why do I think it's right? Because in the Christian Aramaic translations that were in this land that we discovered about 100 and some years ago, where they are, we have these Christian Palestinian lectionaries from the mid to the end of the first millennium, we have the word Gabbata. It's the only Aramaic dialect that has Gabbata. It's not in the older languages because it's a foreign word. It's not in Syriac, but it is in these Christian Palestinian lectionaries. And in there, it's used at the Last Supper where Jesus dips his bread into the bowl. Well, in this lectionary, it says he dips it into the Gabbata. And so it's used in Matthew for this dish, plate, bowl. And it's used here in John, Gabbata. So I think, if I have to choose between Gabbata and Gabbahat, Gabbahat fits Hebrew, Gabbahat fits Aramaic. But Gabbata, I think, fits the context better. To me, it's more probable. So I'm going to call Gabbata Latin.
Latin loanword in Hebrew.
So why does John call it Hebrew? Because when they spoke Hebrew, they said Gabbata. That was the name.
I would too if the choices were between Gabbata and Lithostrotos.
Of course, it makes good sense. Anyway, so that's Gabbata. Let's go up to Beit Zappa. This is John chapter 5, verse 2.
Healing of the
paralytic at the pools in an area that's just north today of the temple area. And they called it, we don't know what they called because our manuscripts divide up. Most of them say Bethesda, but scholars don't like it because the first word that comes to their mind is Bethesda, Bethesed, which both Hebrew and Aramaic have the same meaning of the house of grace. And they say, oh, this fits the story too well. This is obviously some kind of Christian midrash interpretation referring to this place because Jesus did a healing there. All of that is true, but it misses the mark. The texts have other explanations. We cannot throw out Bethesda simply because Hesed has a meaning that would fit too well. We'll come back to Bethesda in just a minute. Beit Zatha almost looks like Beit Zait. In Maccabees, they have the name Beit Zait, and it's spelled with a yud in here and without this A. But the manuscripts later corrupted it. Today, the place Beer Zeit is known. It's a few miles north of Jerusalem.
University.
There's a Palestinian university there today, and this word is associated with it, and Josephus also used Bethzatha for the area of the whole northern city of Jerusalem that was being built after the time of Jesus and before the Great Revolt. And Josephus' area was called Bethzatha. Bethzatha. I think perhaps because the gate would lead right up the road to Beit Zayit, which is what we do today. You know, the gate of Damascus is the road that went to Damascus during the British era. Today in Hebrew, it's the gate of Shechem, Shaul Shechem, and just like the gate right over here is the gate of Jaffa, the road goes west to Jaffa, but Muslims call it the gate of Halil, because it goes down to the city of Hebron, the Halil, friend of God. So it's possible Josephus used Bethzatha because it was the road to Beit Zayit. Beit Zayit it's also called. Perhaps. We don't know. There are other things, and that would get very long and we don't have time for. But these manuscripts are a minority. Let's come back to Bethesda. Instead of Hesed, it turns out Franz Delitzsch, a conservative commentator from 160 years ago, thought that this came from House of Portico. If you don't know what portico is a courtyard that is surrounded by pillars. And it was a brilliant suggestion. And he noticed that in the rabbinic writings, they had, the Greek word here, by the way, is stoa is this portico, the courtyard surrounded by pillars. And in rabbinic writings, this became a loanword. And it was spelled several different ways in the manuscripts. A bunch of funny ways. And Delitzsch said, Bethesda is from this Estiv, and that what you hear as a T sound became a D, in the same way that we have occurrences in the Septuagint and elsewhere where Tet is transliterated with a Dalet, with a Delta in Greek, like the name Put. You all remember your genealogy in Genesis, to the land, the people of Put, with a Tet, and the Greeks, when they transliterated that, wrote Food, or Pud, if you went to the Attic pronunciation. Delta instead of Tet. And so he's explaining Bethesda is coming from this Estiv, Estaba, Estaba, whatever. I said it was a brilliant suggestion. I think he was on the right track. He did see that if this was the transliteration of the word Stoa, then in fact the name fit the context. Because right after he says, in Hebrew they call this place Bethesda, and it has five porticos. He doesn't say it means five porticos, but he says it has five porticos. So what does Bethesda mean? We don't know. John doesn't tell us. But the context would fit if it meant House of Stoa. And what I ran across last month in the Copper Scroll that I didn't bring today,
At Qumran,
we've actually found a transliteration, a loan word in Hebrew, and it's even colloquial Hebrew, in the Copper Scroll. The Copper Scroll in colloquial Hebrew has borrowed the word stoa, and they say istan. Now the N at the end of words is very volatile. It pops on, it drops off. Don't be confused by the N. You know, Siloam, Silwan, actually comes from Shiloh. There's no N, there's no M in it. It just gets added. There are a lot of words and names that in the history of transliterations add or delete a final nasal. So don't let that confuse you from stoa. It is the word stoa, and in Hebrew they said istan in the Copper Scroll. If that nun was not used for the Greek transliterator, I've got some Septuagintal examples of that happening here, but I won't do that right now. Then Beit Esta, Beit Esta is a perfect fit. Beit Esta is a perfect fit for House of the Portico. There were five porticos. It was quite famous. And I think Delitzsch was right. He didn't have the benefit of the copper scroll. If he had the benefit of the copper scroll, I think people would have listened to him.
And then that explains the rest of the verse, having five porches.
Having five porches, exactly. So I think that this has a Greek loanword. Now, what did John say? John said, it's a Hebrew name. And this helps you understand what John is doing and what happens in languages. It is a Hebrew name. Well, the Greek, but the word came from Greek. So, does that mean it can't be a Hebrew name? Of course not. What's wrong with our scholars? Where's their common sense? That they can't look at these words that John says are names in Hebrew and leave John to be, leave him alone with the whole rest of the Greek language. We cannot convict John of misusing the Greek language because he only called three names Hebrew. He called Bethesda, which comes from probably from Greek, he called it a Hebrew name. Is he wrong? No. If he says it's a Hebrew name, it's a Hebrew name. We have Gabbatha, probably from a Latin word, but he says it's a Hebrew name. Is it a Hebrew name? Yeah.
It's like an interview I was listening to yesterday on American radio. They're interviewing an Israeli author, and they asked him what his favorite. They're asking about the complications of translating his books into English, and how some things don't translate. And they said, "Do you have a favorite word in Hebrew?" And he said, "Oh yeah, sure, that's balagan." And he talked about how that's so hard to translate that in English, and it just doesn't translate. Of course, balagan is not even a Hebrew word; it comes from Russian. But in Hebrew, it has taken
sure.
on a very Israeli meaning.
So anyway, it's called a loan word. But these are loan names, which are even a step further in the process, even easier to penetrate borders. These are what you would expect in a language. I'm speaking English, and last November, I went to San Francisco. I do not say San Francisco. I go to San Francisco. That's English. I can say in English, if I'm a pastor, I can preach a sermon and say, Jesus is a Hebrew name that means salvation. Now, there were a lot of mistakes in that sentence I just said, and yet the sentence is true. Jesus is a Hebrew name that means salvation. It sounds just like Yeshua. Technically, a linguist will say, actually, it comes from a different root, shua, that means to cry for help or to be helpful. That's fine. But it also sounds like Yeshua, so if somebody wants to say it means salvation, they're also justified in saying that, and it appears to be behind Matthew 1:21, you shall call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. But I did it again. I said Jesus, and of course, Jesus isn't the way it's said in Hebrew, it's Yeshua, but I cite it, I quote it, Jesus, because that's the form we like to use in English. Just like the Septuagint likes to quote the Aramaic form Pascha when they say Pesach, or Sabbata when they say Shabbat. And Shabbat doesn't even mean anything in Aramaic. The Aramaic word for rest is from Lanuach, Nuach, Nach, not from Shabbat. So when Josephus said that Shabbat is from Hebrew, Shabbat, Sabbata is from Hebrew, it means rest. And a scholar says, no, he's quoting Aramaic, and Hebrew must mean Aramaic. No, that's not true. Josephus said it was Hebrew, and only Hebrew explains the meaning of the name. Josephus was right. The scholars that rewrite Josephus' Greek language are wrong. And yet this is what is in our Greek New Testament Greek to English dictionaries. That's why these translations are coming out with Aramaic. The guy looks it up in the dictionary. The dictionary says Hebrew means Aramaic. Well, I might as well say that English means Hebrew. If I'm going to say that Jesus is a Hebrew name that means salvation and use that logic, then Hebrew means English. And of course, it doesn't. nor did it for Josephus or any of these other people. So finally we get back to John, and we have John quoting three names and a Hebrew word, and he calls them all Hebrew. And he did a good job. But now for me, the irony, if I go back and I talk about the etymology, by the way, Golgotha comes from Golgolet. It's also a Hebrew and an Aramaic word that means skull. Let's take it. Let's assume the name was made during the Persian era, and they put it in the Aramaic form, and locally they were saying Golgotha, the skull. Let's assume it's coming from Aramaic. But John says it's Hebrew, which means that name, when you're speaking Hebrew in Jerusalem, and you're saying, I'm walking by that hill over there, in Hebrew you would say Golgotha. That's what John claims. And we can't disprove John on that. So let's look at what we have. We have Rabuni, a word. John says it's Hebrew, it is Hebrew. So here we have a Hebrew word. Here we have a name whose etymology may have been Aramaic. But in Hebrew it does mean skull, so there's no problem. And Gabbatha, we have a Hebrew name, and it looks like it's a Latin etymology. And in Bethesda, we have a Hebrew name, and the etymology is Greek. So we have Greek, Latin, Aramaic, and Hebrew, all contributing to the first century Hebrew language that John calls Hebrew. And that is the evidence why Hebrew means Hebrew.
Wow.
Hebrew means Hebrew. You mean the ancient writers knew what they were saying and they got it all right? And the answer to that is yes. So anyway, what did we learn today? We learned that John gives us a lot of very interesting background to Jerusalem in the first century. He has some intimate knowledge of this city, and that's valuable. It is complicated, as you've just seen. He's very aware of it being Hebrew. And we also learned that in Acts 21, Paul was able to silence his rioting audience by speaking to them in Hebrew. So that's the background to Ephraisti in the New Testament and John. And it could serve as an introduction to what we call the trilingual background of the New Testament, or of the first century. Thank you very much.